watch things before they're fully built. So it'll be nice with black holes and other wires.
Oh, thank you very much. I'd like to thank Cliff for the invitation, and I feel it's an honor. If only because I get to be the master of the stick for an hour. I've been dreaming of that day, you know, where I would be holding the stick. Hello? I have to turn this on first.
We can't play mind the man.
So I think this is on now. Yeah. Okay, so I want to tell you something about black holes in tidal environments, and I'll have a chance to explain what I mean by a tidal environment. I don't think I have to explain what I mean by black hole to this audience. So here's an outline of the talk. So I'll set out my goals, and I'll explain the motivation behind those goals on the first slide. Essentially, what I want to do is to take a black hole that otherwise would be spherical and non-rotating, so that would be a Schwarzschild black hole. I want to place it in a tidal environment, and all that means is that I'm going to place it in a place where there are nearby masses that are actually producing tidal forces that will be acting on the black hole. I want to describe that in the best way that I can, and I want to extract physical consequences of all of this. And of course, I have to do this in a way that allows me to attack the problem, and there might be numerical ways of attacking this problem that would allow you to treat black holes in close contact or, you know, in close interaction with other nearby bodies. What I choose to do instead is to choose an analytical route based on perturbation theory, where my black hole is still subjected to gravitational interactions from other bodies, but the bodies are sufficiently far away that the interaction is significant but not strong. So the first thing that I'll do then is to describe the separation scales that allows me to set up a perturbation theory for this problem, and I'll explain what the two scales are in this problem, and describe how you can have this separation of scales that I need to work out the problem. I'll spend quite a bit of time on the Newtonian version of this problem, where I forget about the black hole, but I replace this by some kind of diffuse star. It turns out that the tidal interaction physics of a Newtonian body, well, it's complicated enough, interesting enough, but also very revealing in terms of what you can do with that. And in fact, it'll be interesting to see the contrast between, you know, what happens when you do this in full general relativity, well outside the Newtonian regime, see how closely analogous the results actually turn out to be. So first I'll start with the Newtonian problem, where things are really relatively easy, and then I'll move on to the relativity problem, and you'll see this close analogy that I claim is there. And then what I want to do is to, well, extract some clear physical consequences that will have, in fact, measurable impact in gravitational wave astronomy. And after that, I'll just conclude. And hopefully, I'll have time to cover all of this. OK, so what do I want to do here? What I want to do, first of all, is to, well, do what I said, place my black hole in some kind of tidal environment, and let it be subjected to the tidal forces and also the direct gravitational attraction that's created by the other bodies. And that, of course, means calculating the metric of this perturbed black hole. I'm going to choose my black hole to be non-rotating for the purposes of this talk. I have all sorts of results for rotating black holes, but they're just messier to state, and I just won't go there. I'll be happy to just restrict my attention to a non-rotating black hole. So it's moving in some external universe that contains other bodies, and as I said, it's subjected to their gravitational field. And what I'm mostly interested in is the tidal physics associated with those other bodies. So I want to do that, and I also want to extract from this notion of tidally heating the black hole. And what I mean by that is that, as we're going to see, as a result of the tidal interaction between the black hole and the other bodies, what we have is a situation where the horizon area will grow in time, and that's a phenomenon. You know, growing horizon means growing event horizon, growing area means growing entropy. That's the phenomenon of gravitational tidal heating of a black hole, and that's the effect that I claim has measurable consequences. And I wanted to calculate this. There have been partial calculations of that effect in the past, I have a more general set of results about this, and I wanted to get more insight about this phenomenon, which I find very fascinating. So as I say here, this is this tidal heating of a black hole, which I hope I'll be able to explain in the course of this talk, will have, is something that can be actually measured in gravitational wave observations if they're precise enough. And I think we have a good chance of having this if there's ever a space-based detector for gravitational waves. So in the context of the binary system, that would involve at least one black hole, while the increase of the black hole mass, which comes from the increase of the black hole area, this phenomenon of tidal heating, does impact the energy balance, where you conserve total energy, but you lose orbital energy to gravitational waves, but also tidal heating. And this is something that I think can be measured. That's what I say here, and that's a partial list of the literature where this effect was explored, and what I set out to do a few years ago, and starting that paper over here, is to try to come up with, as I said, a more general description of this phenomenon, and also try to achieve higher insight into this problem. And as I said, I have to, while I set out to do this through perturbation theory, which means that I need two scales, the ratio of which will be small. And there are two scales in this problem. One, obviously, is set by the black hole, and that's the black hole mass M. That's the first length scale associated with the problem. The second length scale is what I call the tidal radius. It's a curly R quantity that will stay with us for the rest of the talk. I call it the tidal radius. You might also call it the local radius of curvature. That's the curvature scale that's set by the other bodies that are present. That's not a scale that's set by the black hole itself. And on the next slide, I'll just make the assumption that the ratio of those two quantities has to be small compared with one. So just to give you an example, I set out to treat a very general situation here where I don't care how many extra bodies I have in my situation. But the typical example is one involving a two-body system, one body being the black hole, and the other body could be also another black hole, it doesn't matter, some other object of mass M external. When I talk about the curvature of the external universe, I essentially mean the mass of the external universe divided by the distance to it, cubed. That would be a typical component of the Riemann tensor associated with the external universe. And the unit of the Riemann tensor is 1 over length squared. So this is the 1 over tidal radius squared. That's the definition of it, essentially. So it's the radius of curvature associated with the nearby bodies. What I've done here is to write this simple expression here in a slightly more complicated way by involving the orbital velocity of the black hole in the two-body orbit. And I just wanted to point out that the 1 over the square of the tidal radius scales like the sixth power of the orbital velocity. I've set my units g equals c equals 1 here. So this is the orbital velocity as a function of the total mass divided by the radius of the orbit. And we have a factor involving the mass ratio and a factor involving the orbital velocity. So that's an example of a concrete situation involving a tidal field acting on the black hole produced by the other body of the binary system. So this is my two main assumptions. So I'm assuming a small ratio of the two scales. M over curly R is very small compared to 1. That allows me to treat the other bodies as creating a small perturbation on the black hole. And also, when I write down the metric, when I solve for the perturbed metric of my tidally distorted black hole, what I'll assume here is that I'm actually working in a region which is fairly close to the black hole. I can be as close to the black hole as I want. R, I'll assume, is larger than M, but that's not essential. I could cover some region inside the black hole, but that's not terribly interesting. But what I'll assume, which is very important, is the fact that my distance scale away from the black hole is also small compared with the tidal radius scale. And the reason for this is that I want to work close to the black hole. I don't want to approach any of the other bodies that might be present in my system. And the reason for this will become clear, I hope. The idea is that I want to avoid describing the tidal environment in too many details, but I want to introduce just the right amount of detail. And if I restrict myself to this region over here, there's a very clean, useful way of doing that. So I can be very general without having to be extremely detailed all of the same time. So again, going back to my example of a binary system, if I calculate the mass ratio according to the scale ratio according to the formula I gave you before, what you find is that while the ratio of mass to tidal radius is given by this expression right here, again involving something you know, that depends on the mass ratio, and this time involving the cube of the orbital velocity, and we're looking into a situation where this quantity is small compared with 1. And there are ways of making it true, you know, of making this ratio small compared with 1. And while there are lots of ways you can do that, but there are two interesting ways of making this happen. One is simply to arrange for the mass ratio to be small. If the mass ratio between the black hole and the other external body is small, then this ratio is guaranteed to be small, no matter how fast the black hole is moving on its binary orbit. And that allows me to have a very small black hole, but in a very deep gravitational field, very relativistic, I could have a very small black hole moving deeply in the gravitational field of a very large black hole. So I can treat very deep relativistic situations in this formalism. That's the small hole approximation. The other way of arranging this, if I don't want to restrict myself to small mass ratios, is to restrict myself to small orbital velocities. So here is a situation where I could have a large black hole in orbit around another large black hole. But if the mutual gravity of the two bodies is weak, the orbital velocity will be slow, and that is also something that produces a small ratio of my two scales. This is the slow motion approximation. And obviously, there are other ways you can arrange things, but those are, I think, the two interesting regimes. And the thing to remember here is that the method of approximation that I'm introducing is not slow motion necessarily, is not small mass ratio necessarily, it's a combination of the two ideas. And in particular, in this context here, I can still have access to very relativistic situations. The context of having a small black hole moving in the deep relativistic field of a larger black hole, say a 10 solar mass black hole around a million solar mass black hole, is the type of sources of gravitational waves that would be interesting for a space-based detector. So that's the context of the calculation. All right, so let me explain how this all works out in the Newtonian situation, and I'll assume here that all of us are sophisticated people trained in theoretical physics, and the Newtonian theory of gravity doesn't scare anybody in this room. And in case, you know, you start to feel a bit uneasy, let me just remind you that general relativity is the low energy limit of quantum gravity, and Newtonian physics is just, you know, Newtonian physics is just, you know, something that's low, low, low energy in this scale. Okay, so in this problem, I don't have a black hole, but I still have an object which that has a mass, and I'm still assuming this separation of scales that I introduced before. So I have an object of mass m, and as I'm doing for the black hole, I'm also assuming that if that object were in isolation, it would be a spherical body of a certain mass. And if I were to describe the unperturbed Newtonian potential that would be produced by this body, well, it would be spherically symmetric potential, monopole potential. It would be given by m over r. That's the Newtonian potential of my Newtonian body in complete isolation. But of course, I don't want to put it in isolation. I want to let it gravitationally interact with other bodies. And I'll describe the field produced by all of the extra bodies present, one or many, by this external potential phi external. And this is the thing that I'm introducing as a perturbation. This is the thing that will produce a tidal distortion in my you know, initially spherical body. So we do that, and we're asking a number of questions. Well, the first question I should ask is, how am I to describe the tidal environment? Well, one answer is that, well, I just prescribe the potential, and that's it. But it turns out that there's a clever way of doing that, which I'll introduce next time. Useful, not clever, but useful way of describing the tidal environment, again, without introducing too many details if you don't want to. One question is, what is going to be the tidal response of the body? The tidal field exerted by the other bodies will deform the shape of my spherical body, and it won't be spherical any longer. Associated with that perturbation, there'll be a perturbation of its gravitational field. I want to calculate that. And, you know, what kind of interesting physical consequences might there be as a result of this tidal interaction? And, you know, you'll see that there's really something there, even though the calculation is simple and the context is simple, there's a lot going on already. What you have to keep in mind as I go through the discussion is that everything that I'm asking here, I'll be asking later in the relativistic context. And a lot of what I'm saying here, I'll be saying later. Here, I'll be saying it in Newtonian physics. Later, I'll be saying it in full general relativity. But you're going to see strong similarities between what I say here and what I'll say then. OK, the first job, and that's really the hardest part of the problem in some sense, is to describe the tidal environment. And what I want to do is to describe a very general situation. I don't want to specify how many bodies I have on top of my central body of interest. I want to describe a very general tidal environment. But I want to do it in a way that that uses this clean separation of scales that I've introduced in a way that will simplify the later calculations. And the idea is to say that instead of specifying the tidal environment through a function that could be complicated, I'm going to use the fact that that I have separation of scales in the problem to do a Taylor expansion of my external potential about the center of mass of my central body. And the separation of scales will tell me that each successive term in the Taylor expansion will be small, and I'll keep only the terms that I really need to get the job done. So essentially, the idea is this. I take my potential as a function of position away from the center of mass. I evaluate it at zero. I take the first derivative. I take the second derivative. And if I wanted more accuracy, I would keep going, but I'll just stop here for now. OK, well, the potential at zero I don't care about because, you know, as far as the positional dependence is concerned, it's just a constant. It's not going to produce any force, so I throw that away very gladly. The linear term is what has given me the center of mass acceleration of the body as a whole. So the body, of course, if we're part of a binary system, you know, my single bound body is going to move around the other body, so there's a center of mass acceleration that accounts for the orbital motion. But that I'll throw away too, because I'll be working in the moving frame of my central body. I'll be moving to a co-moving frame, and I'll just be throwing away that term also. I'm not interested about I'm not interested in this center of mass motion. What I really want is what's left over after I've thrown all of that away. And what's left over is the statement that, well, gravity inside the body is not constant. Gravity will change. It's going to be a little bit stronger on the face of the body that faces the other body. It's going to be a little bit weaker over here. So there's going to be some change as I move within the body in the gravitational field. That's measured by second derivatives of the external potential. So that's the derivative of the gravitational acceleration inside the body. And that's the thing that, after evaluating at the center of mass, gives me a tensorial description of the tidal field acting on the body. So that's where I can give a very general description, but a very easy, very convenient description of the tidal environment through essentially an arbitrary tensor field that depends only on time. And the full tidal potential is this over here. It's quadratic in position inside the star. With this formalism, I can handle a very complicated tidal environment, or I can handle a very simple tidal environment. All of that information is contained in here. And until I come back later to, again, the case of a binary system, I'll never specify what the tidal environment actually is. I'll just provide what I want here when it's time to apply the formalism to any specific case. You had a question?
Yes, you use the small coordinate x. What are the assumptions which guarantee that there are no forces proportional to the inverse powers of this coordinate?
So this is all Newtonian physics, so there's no issue of choosing coordinates or anything like that. It's a Cartesian coordinate system. All I'm assuming here is that I have a regular function. The external potential is a smooth regular function, differentiable as many times as I want. And I'm just doing a straightforward Taylor expansion about the center. And there will not be singular terms because this function is not singular across the body of the, of, you know, across the body. Is that sufficient in answer?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the Newtonian force of a single body goes by long distance, so.
Oh, yes, so if I were near any of the other bodies that I'm introducing to produce the tidal environment, I would approach, you know, if there were point masses, I would approach the singularity. The point here is that, and that's the idea of the separation of scales, is that I'm sufficiently removed from any body that I can do, that I'm not close to a singularity, and in particular, there's no hint that I would generate a singularity right here. So that's the idea. So, yeah, so it's a very good question. Okay, so that's the idea. So I'm going to use this as a description of the tidal environment, and I'll never need to really specify a lot of its details. So here it is again. I get my external potential, differentiate twice with respect to the coordinates, evaluate all of that at the center of mass of my body. That defines what I call the tidal gravitational field produced by all the extra bodies in my system. And that quantity here, which has units of 1 over length squared, sets the tidal radius scale that I mentioned before. So that's the main player, and it's going to play, you know, it's going to be the main player in the Newtonian discussion. It's also going to be the main player in the relativistic discussion, but of course it's going to be introduced slightly differently in the relativistic case. The full tidal potential, you know, truncated to some order of accuracy, is this quadratic potential that I'm describing here, and it scales as distance away from the center of mass to the tidal radius squared. And again, the scaling assumptions that I made before ensured that this ratio was actually small anywhere near the star. And that tells me then that the external potential, the tidal potential, is actually a small perturbation. And then I can go and calculate, you know, what its effect on the star actually, what it's going to be. Okay. In the Newtonian problem, this is where it gets messy. Because the only way I can calculate what the star is going to be or what the body is going to do as a response to the tidal interaction is to make a model for what that body actually consists of. In relativity, I don't have to worry about this. If I'm dealing with black holes, I don't have to provide a model for the internal structure of the black hole. It's all gravity, it's all curvature of space-time. But in Newtonian physics, I don't have that. I have to make a choice as to what my body is going to be, and then I can calculate the response. So this is where it gets messy. So in a very true sense, the relativistic problem is much cleaner than the Newtonian problem, and easier because you don't have to worry about what the matter distribution is. Okay, so to make any progress here, I do have to make a choice, and what I'll do here is to model my my star, my central body, as a fluid ball. It's going to be, for simplicity, an incompressible fluid, so the density inside the star is going to be constant. But to make life a little bit more interesting, I'll incorporate viscosity into the discussion, and you'll see that viscosity has an important role to play in this case. So I have a viscous incompressible fluid that, you know, in isolation would be spherical, but now I have introduced a distortion, and I have to calculate the effect of this tidal interaction on the structure of the body. And in order to, you know, solve this problem, I have to deal with the fluid mechanics of, you know, of a deformed body, and that involves solving the Navier-Stokes equation for the velocity field inside the fluid. Lots of details here, pages and pages of calculations here. That's where it gets really hard. I'll save you being shown all those details, but I'll just give you the, you know, the punchline on this. So just take my word that by solving the fluid mechanics equations, you can actually discover, given the tidal forces acting on the body, what its deformation is going to be. I could describe the deformation in terms, for example, of the actual deformation of the stellar surface. That's one calculation that was required in this. But what I choose to do instead is to describe the deformation through the quadrupole moment tensor of the mass distribution. The quadrupole moment tensor is defined in this way. It's essentially the inertia tensor, the moment of inertia tensor of the body, but I've removed the trace of that, so it's a trace-free tensor. And the reason why I removed the trace is simply that, you know, if you had a spherical body, the quadrupole moment would be zero. So the quadrupole moment tensor is actually a good measure of the non-spherical nature of the perturbed object. So So you do the calculation, you calculate the status structure, you know, as perturbed by tidal forces, you evaluate all of these things, and you end up with this very nice clean expression that I've highlighted over here. So the quadrupole moment tensor turns out to be in direct proportion to the tidal field. That's not surprising. The tidal field is what's creating the displacements, and this is something that measures how much displacement occurs. So you would have guessed that Q would have to be proportional to curly E. You would have also guessed the A to the fifth power, A is the stellar radius, simply by a dimensional argument to make the units come out right. You have to have this dependence on A to the fifth power. You may not have guessed that the distortion now would depend on the field, not now, but a little bit earlier. There's a delay in here. The dependence at time t depends on what the applied field was actually doing, not at the same time, but at an earlier time. There is a delay. There's a viscous delay, and that's why I wanted viscosity, because I wanted to produce this delay. The viscosity of the body actually means that the tidal bulge of the body is not going to be perfectly aligned with the other object. It's going to be lagging. And that's well-known physics. That's the same for the Earth's oceans. There's a mismatch between the direction of the tidal bulge and the direction of the other body producing the tidal forces. So anyway, so you have to work a little bit harder to calculate this 1/2. You have to calculate a lot harder to calculate this 19/2. But the tidal delay essentially depends on two things. It depends on the ratio of the radius to the mass of the span. And it also depends on how much viscosity you have, and the more viscosity you have, the larger the delay is going to be.
Do you have also some quadrupoles due to the rotation of the star?
Or? Yes, thank you. So I've assumed all along that my star is non-rotating for simplicity, because eventually I'll be moving on to the case of a rotating black hole.
How is it, say, if I take a sun, is it the tidal forces created by Jupiter,
are we
creating more quadrupole
than
the rotation? Than the no. I'd say the rotation is more, right?
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's a small correction.
To the rotationally induced quadrupole moment. In the case of the Earth, I think the orders of magnitude are similar. Yeah, but I don't remember. But yeah, it's a good point that, you know, I don't have rotation here, therefore I don't have an oblateness created by the rotation. Okay. You'll want to know why I've introduced this viscous delay, and the reason will appear in the next slide. But anyway, that's the result. You get this direct proportionality between the applied tidal field and the amount of distortion that the body suffers as a result of the tidal interaction. Nu, by the way, is just one of those coefficient of viscosity that, in this case, is the one that factors out the density, so it's called the kinematic viscosity. By people who do fluid dynamics. So here we have, we have an answer to the question, you know, what is going to be the result on the star given the tidal field. Having calculated this quadrupole moment, we also have the answer on what is going to be the gravitational perturbation that's going to be associated with this tidal distortion. The idea is that the potential of the body is no longer perfectly spherically symmetric. It's going to be altered by a quadrupole term in the multiple expansion. And if I kept more accuracy, I would have also higher order multiples entering into the description of the gravitational field outside the body. When I move on to the black hole situation, I want to know the equivalent of this answer, but formulated in terms of the metric outside the distorted black hole. Why did I want viscosity? I wanted viscosity because I wanted to introduce this mismatch between the alignment of the tidal bulge and the direction of the other body creating the tidal perturbation. The phase mismatch that we've seen between the quadrupole moment and the applied tidal field means that when I actually look at the forces done, not the forces, but the work done by the tidal forces acting on the body, I get something that doesn't cancel out after an orbital period. If everything was in phase, I would get, you know, an exchange of energy back and forth between the object and the tidal environment, but all of that would cancel out over an orbital cycle, and there would be no net work done on my central body. Allowing for the mismatch, the phase mismatch, allowing for the viscosity, actually turns out, you know, turns out this canceling result into something that that doesn't cancel out over time. So if I calculate the amount of work done by the tidal forces on my distorted body, I get an answer like this, which depends on the time change, the time derivative of the tidal field squared. That's what I get here. I get something that also scales like the fifth power of the stellar radius. That's not surprising because I came from before. But I also get something that's directly proportional to the tidal delay or the viscous delay. And that's something that therefore needs viscosity to operate. That turns out to be rather important from a physical point of view, because if you now look at the physical consequences of this tidal interaction, you have the central body perturbed by the other bodies acquiring internal energy because the tidal interaction keeps on doing work on that central body. So the body keeps increasing its internal energy. So that's something that's significant. There's also a mechanism for dissipating that internal energy. The viscosity will also be very good at dissipating heat. And in fact, if you calculate, given the work done on the body, how much of that goes into heat by viscous dissipation, the answer is that all of it goes into that. So now you have a mechanism of turning the tidal forces, the tidal energy, into heat energy inside your fluid body.
But is that related to the fact that it's not rotating? Because if it's rotating, it can just slow down.
Okay, let me come back to that point. It's a very good point. I'll come back to it in just a second because I really want to talk about actual realizations of this scenario. Raphael?
This yellow box, that's the secular bit for the average over one orbit or something. Right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yes, I did average over an orbital cycle to get this result. That's the secular thing that doesn't cancel out over an orbital cycle. Okay, before I answer Laurent's question, I'll just talk about IO, because if you're wondering, has this ever been seen, has this, you know, this conversion of tidal energy into heat been observed? The answer is yes, it has been observed. And in fact, it's been observed through the most spectacular volcanic activity that's ever been found in the solar system. That's not on Earth, that's within Io. Io is the innermost satellite of Jupiter. And being the innermost satellite of Jupiter, it's actually very, largely subjected to the tidal forces acting on it by Jupiter. And if you look at the surface of Io, you'll notice that it's pretty heavily pockmarked. If you look at those features more closely, in fact, you discover that they're actually active volcanoes, and once in a while you have a large eruption taking place. You see one of them taking place over here, and I have a little movie that I stole from the site that you see listed here that actually shows a sequence of stills that shows an eruption taking place. And look at the scale of that thing. It's a huge eruption coming off the surface. And the mechanism for this has been identified as tidal heating. It's tidal energy that's being converted with an Io into heat and then into volcanism.
What's the time scale?
The time scale for between eruptions? I really don't know. I frankly, I don't know. That's the thing that was.
The time scale for the planet to heat, you know?
Well, I guess that there are two time scales here. First is the eruption time, and then the frequency of such eruptions.
Well, but that depends on the property of the surface. It's nothing to do with any convention.
Right. So if I remember correctly, the time scale is the orbital time scale is of the order of several hours. No, a couple of days. It's a couple of days for an orbital period. The viscous delay time scale is of the order of a couple of hours, something along those lines. The time scale between eruptions, I really don't know. That's not something that I've ever known about. To come back to Laurent's point, it's very important to have this mismatch between the direction of the tidal bulge and the direction of the tidal field. If you have a rotating body, and if you have a body that's actually like for the Earth-Moon system in a co-rotational state, you lose that. You have a stationary situation. and the mechanism would stop happening. So here I have a mechanism, I have a working mechanism because I don't have rotation. For IO, you do have co-rotational state. What gives the time dependence that's required for the mechanism to work is the eccentricity of IO's orbit in this case. So I'm talking about slightly different cases, but there is a time dependence that survives because the orbit is actually eccentric, and the gravity, the strength of gravity does change in the course of one orbit. That's enough to make things work. Okay. Well, let me move on to the fully relativistic situation. And
wait, is this force strong enough to change the eccentricity of orbits over over a certain time scale?
I think that there's been historical evolution within the solar system. Certainly for the Earth-Moon system, there's been secular changes in the orbital elements over time. In this particular case, I'm not sure, and I think it's probably not going to happen because I think it's true that all of the tidal energy is converted entirely into heat in this case. I'm not completely sure about that, but yeah. I mean, these things do evolve over billions of years, and there might be.
Well, in this case, part of what's going on is that Europa comes behind it, and it keeps IO completely being synchronized with Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just internal to IO's orbit, but there was also the other ones perturbing the orbit.
So the physics is a bit more complicated than just two bodies. Okay, so how do you go about describing all of this, or you're doing something similar in full general relativity? Well, essentially you want to do the same thing, but now you have a real black hole at the center, and you want to place other bodies nearby, and you want to come up with a description of the tidal environment in a way that makes sense in general relativity. And then you want to calculate, the perturbometric of the black hole, and you want to extract consequences, and perhaps something similar to the tidal heating phenomenon that we've seen just before, something that would apply not to a fluid body in this case, but would apply to a black hole. And the first thing that really needs to be done here is to describe the tidal environment. And this will not involve second derivatives of a Newtonian potential, obviously, but you're going to pick what is appropriate in general relativity to do that, and that's going to be the Riemann tensor or the Weyl curvature, the Weyl tensor, given that we're working in vacuum here, that's going to be set by the conditions in the external universe. So those are all the questions that I'm going to be asking, and we'll see what the answers are as we get along. The first thing I'll do is to describe the unperturbed situation, and I hope that this will go smoothly. The unperturbed black hole is non-rotating and spherical, and it's described by a Schwarzschild metric. The only twist that I'll add to that story, which is well known, is the fact that I'm not going to describe the black hole, the metric, in terms of the usual Schwarzschild coordinates. What I'll do instead is to switch to null coordinates that follow light cones as opposed to following time as measured at infinity. So after a very trivial transformation of the usual Schwarzschild time coordinate, I could cast the Schwarzschild metric in this form right here. And I want to give you the geometrical meaning of the coordinates because this will be important when I start perturbing the metric. V is something that's constant on incoming light cones that converge toward the black hole. It's a null coordinate. I can picture or I can construct those converging light cones in terms of the null generators of the null cones. And in fact, the coordinates are such that theta and phi, the angular coordinates, happen to be constant on each generator forming the null cones. So that's a useful property of the angular coordinates, that they have this labeling property on null generators. R also has a geometrical meaning in terms of being an affine parameter on those incoming null generators, on top of having this well-known property of being an aerial radius in the sense that if you take a surface V, R constant, the metric is the metric of a sphere, and R measures the area of each of those two spheres. So here's a description of this. You have the time runs upward, space is sideways, you have the world tube of the event horizon. The event horizon is located at R equals 2m. In Schwarzschild space-time, you have a converging null cone. All the generators would converge toward the singularity of the center. And the statement is that V, my null coordinate, is actually constant on this null cone. And as I stack up the null cones, I have surfaces of constant V. This is one typical generator on the null cone. This is another. And the point is that theta and phi are constant on each of those generators, and R runs along the generator, and it turns out it's an affine parameter on those null cones. So I think all of that is very known, well known, but what I'm going to want to do is to perturb the spacetime, perturb the metric, and I'm going to insist to do that and preserve the geometrical meaning of the coordinates. So the geometrical meaning of the coordinates, because it can be identified easily without involving necessarily the details of the Schwarzschild metric, can actually be preserved in the perturbation field. And that turns out to be a very, very important property. Before I come to that, well, let me try to give you an idea of how to specify a tidal environment. When you take your black hole, you remove it from its state of complete isolation and place it in the middle of some other field of other bodies. The body will be moving in the space-time that's going to be created by the other bodies. It's going to be in gravitational interaction with the other bodies. And in fact, what I want to do is to come up with a description of the metric far away from the black hole, but still close enough that I'm not actually, you know, encountering any of those nearby bodies. So I want to give the relativistic version of expressing the external potential in Newtonian theory as a Taylor expansion about r equals 0. But of course, I can't quite do that, so I'm going to have to be a little bit more careful, a bit more clever about how to do this. And the idea is something like this. If I'm an observer moving in the space-time and I'm far away from the black hole, I will observe that the gravity of the black hole is very small, and in fact, the gravitational fields that I measure will be, you know, created mostly by the other bodies that are setting up my tidal environment. If I work there, but also here, I can actually describe the metric in my region in a way that closely matches what I was doing before in terms of Taylor expansion. I'll just display how I do that. What I'm going to do, instead of using v, r, theta, and phi as coordinates in for the next little while, what I'll do instead is to convert my r, theta, phi coordinates into Cartesian-like coordinates, x, y, and z. So I'll still have v as my time coordinate, but I'll use sort of Cartesian-like coordinates for the spatial coordinates. And those coordinates will be centered on the black hole from to some extent. And I'll just warn you right now that what I'm constructing here is a light cone version of what's known as Fermi-normal coordinates. And it will have essentially the same properties that you would expect Fermi-normal coordinates to have. And I'll show you what this is just now. As I said, in a region where we're far away from the black hole, but close enough to the black hole that we're still within the tidal radius, or the external radius of curvature, as I defined it before, I can express the metric in this light cone system that's closely analogous to Fermi coordinates, and it will take a form that looks like this, and it looks an awful lot like the Taylor expansion of my external gravitational field that I had in Newtonian theory. It has this property of Fermi coordinates in the following sense. Fermi coordinates are coordinate systems that are based on geodesic word lines. They have the property that if you're moving on the word line, the metric that you assign to the word line is actually the Minkowski metric. So the time-time component of the metric on the word line is actually 1, or minus 1. There's no linear term, because the motion is geodesic, and that's just a statement that on the geodesic, all the Christoffel symbols are 0. So it's a coordinate system that enforces local flatness. You have Minkowski metric and 0 Christoffel symbols everywhere on the word line. If you ask, can you continue this to second order and let the second order term also be 0, the answer is no. That's prevented by the Riemann curvature. So a coordinate system like this will have the property of being constant on the word line and taking the Minkowski values on the word line. Its first derivative is going to be 0, but its second derivative is actually going to be determined in terms of the Riemann tensor. What I have here is a component of the metric that uses the same ideas, but instead of using Fermi coordinates that would be based on, you know, spatial distances, I'm using this null cone structure that I introduced before to do that. But it's very much the same idea. The point is that this quantity right here, which used to be defined in terms of second derivatives of the Newtonian potential, now acquires appropriate relativistic definition. It essentially becomes components of the Weyl tensor the bile tensor that's set by the tidal environment, the bile tensor that's produced by the external bodies external to the black hole. And it's set by the external bodies because in this region, the gravitational influence of the black hole is negligible. That's the idea. So this is the form of the metric that neglects everything that comes from the black hole, and we neglect higher order terms that are also neglected in the Newtonian situation. That is how we specify the tidal environment in as much generality as we did before Newtonian theory, but now we're doing it in full general relativity. The tidal environment is entirely contained in the values that you set for the external bile tensor through those quantities right here. I should say that there are the quantities involved in general relativity. Here I'm talking about the electric components of the bile tensor, if that means anything to some of you. There are also magnetic components. They are also involved, but not in this particular component of the metric, and I'll just show you the time-time component of the metric here to save messiness and to keep my equation short. What do I do with that? Well, I'm hoping to perturb the black hole and move closer in and actually worry about what I've neglected over here. And here's, I'll come back to you in just a sec, John. Here's the strategy. If I didn't have a tidal environment, this one over here would be the correct asymptotic value for the metric far away from the black hole. That would be the asymptotic flat condition. And I know how to solve the Einstein field equations for an isolated black hole in asymptotic flatness. When I turn this on, I change the asymptotic conditions from being one to something that actually grows quadratically in the distance away from the black hole. What I have to do is to solve the equations for a perturbed black hole, the Einstein field equations for a perturbed black hole, knowing that this is the correct asymptotic behavior that corresponds to my tidal interaction. That's the strategy. John?
This is probably an old question. If you, once the star collapses to the black hole, how do we know that the black hole solution is safe? If work has been done with linear provision theory, as far as I know, no one ever solved the nonlinear supporting problem. So we don't know that black hole is stable from the nonlinear supporting problem analysis.
That's true. So they're uniqueness theorems. And if you believe in cosmic censorship, then this would tell you that the final state after the collapse will be a black hole state. If you question cosmic censorship, you're right, but there's some linear stability problem, analyses that show linear stability. Usually when you have linear stability, you won't suspect that nonlinear terms, which should be subdominant, will start dominating, but yeah, I mean, I think that there's still something unproven.
Yeah, but there's no linear stability
problems that tell you often. Oh, of course, yeah. There's been a little bit of work on that, but probably nothing very persuasive. No, so I'm assuming the block.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm slowly running out of time, so I don't want to, just a second, I don't want to say too much about how I'm solving the equations, but I do want to say something about preserving the geometrical meaning of the coordinates as I'm doing that. You had a question?
Yeah, sure. I think it's related to the previous question. So,
yeah.
Your geometry is not globally sparse anymore, right?
That's right.
So, how do you define the event horizon, which is basically like a global concept? So, it's a boundary of the past of the non infinity. Let's define.
I'll come back to that because once I've calculated the metric, I'll want to ask where is the event horizon. And how do I know it's the event horizon? I'll come back to that. But you're certainly right that my space-time is no longer asymptotically flat because I'm working in a local region. And that, well, is something that you need to deal with. Let me just say a few words about this. So what I'm trying to do next, or what I would be doing next, having specified something about the asymptotic conditions that will give me the tidal environment, I want to solve for the perturb metric in terms of a perturbation away from the Schwarzschild solution. And at the order I'm going to be working in, it's going to be sufficient to do a linearized calculation. I'm going to be linearizing the Einstein field equation about the Schwarzschild metric. There's a huge literature on how to do that. And if you read any paper on perturbation theory in general relativity, you're going to find that the word gauge appears everywhere. And it tends to be a word that confuses people, that generates debates that last 30 years. And in cosmology, it's created endless confusion over how do you get rid of the gauge information and recuperate only what is really physically measured, physically meaningful. All of those issues are present also in black hole perturbation theory. My statement to this is that, well, choosing a gauge is choosing a coordinate system. We have complete freedom in general relativity in choosing a coordinate system, so why not choose a good one? And the unperturbed coordinate system that I have for my Schwarzschild metric based on incoming light cones had a very clear, clean geometrical meaning. What I want to do in black hole perturbation theory is to keep that clean geometrical meaning for my coordinates. And the statement is that it can be done. I can impose gauge conditions on my metric perturbation that achieves all of that. It achieves that V will continue to label incoming light cones. The light cones now are not going to be the nice spherical light cones that I had before. That picture will become bumpy. My black hole will evolve over time. There'll be all sorts of bumps everywhere. My light cone is going to be bumpy. But what's not going to change is the fact that V is constant on the bumpy light cones, that the bumpy generators will still be labeled by theta and phi, which will be constant on the bumpy curvy generators. R will stay an affine parameter on the null cones. And on top of that, life is really good in this coordinate system. R is still an aerial radius. And to partly answer your question, but not fully, I'll make the claim that in this coordinate system, in this choice of gauge, the event horizon stays at the same coordinate position. If you think that's just too much, I agree with you, but it's true. You can't find a gauge, and I call it the light cone gauge, and I've explored it quite a bit with a former graduate student. The light cone gauge actually allows me to achieve all of this and to present the perturbation of the metric in a very clean, very clear coordinate system. And I think that removes a lot of the vexing issues associated with gauge degrees of freedom. Well, now it becomes a crank. You know, you've just turned the crank, you've chosen the asymptotic conditions, you've chosen the coordinate system, you just go and solve the linearized field equations about the Schwarzschild solution, and you get something like this. This would be the Schwarzschild term. This is the new term that comes from the tidal environment. And if you, for example, so this would be the metric corrected to this order in an expansion about distance from the black hole to the tidal radius cubed. And what you'll notice is that, well, if you turn this off, you get back Schwarzschild. If you turn off the math by going far away, you end up with the right asymptotic expression that I displayed before that corresponds to an observer moving in a tidal environment. And on top of that, well, this does satisfy the Einstein field equations in vacuum up to this order of accuracy. So to get that is not a difficult exercise. What I wanted to do, though, is to go beyond this, and the recent work that I've been involved in was to actually calculate this term, and this is what you get, and now I'm stuck with an order four remainder. What I want to do in the next 7 months is to try to calculate this term, and I'll tell you why I want to keep going in this. It's not too important to read what's going on here. The first line is just a reproduction of this. The corrections that appear at this order involve the time derivative of the tidal field. And it also involves not the quadrupole field, but also the octuple field, something that I did neglect in the Newtonian situation. Anyway, so this is the sort of thing that you get. And given the metric, you can now start asking questions like, where's the event horizon? How do we know it's there? And so on and so forth. Now, given that you don't have asymptotic flatness, it's a little bit problematic to go and identify where the event horizon is. And if we were dealing with a non-linear perturbation of the Schwarzschild solution, something that would deviate strongly from a Schwarzschild solution, it would be, in fact, impossible to locate the event horizon. What saves us here is the fact that we're talking about a small change. And if we know that the horizon is only perturbed slightly from its older self, if the change is infinitesimal in some sense, or at least very small, while you know that you're not going to lose the event horizon by introducing the perturbation, or at least you assume it, And then it becomes a simple matter to locate, you know, a non-hyper surface that has all the right properties to be an event horizon. And in the coordinate system that I've adopted, and given the gaze choices that I've made, the coordinate description of the event horizon is actually the same as it was before, so it's still located at r equals 2L. The geometry of the event horizon certainly is non-spherical. You can measure that in all sorts of ways. For example, you can construct the two-dimensional Ricci scalar associated with the horizon surface. Another way of measuring it is through the surface gravity of the perturbed horizon. 1 over 4m would be the surface gravity of the Schwarzschild black hole. Here's the correction that you would get from the tidal interaction. Notice that it depends on the time derivative of the tidal field. If I had a static perturbation, I would not get a change. And the reason is that if I did get a change, it would have to be quadrupolar. But that's precluded because, you know, the zero plug guarantees that the surface gravity has to be uniform on the event horizon. So if I want to produce a perturbation, I have to introduce a time dependence into the problem. And that's what I'm saying here. In the Newtonian situation, I was going after the tidal heating of my fluid body. And now I want to talk to you about the tidal heating of the black hole. And what I want to find from my perturbed metric is an indication that my event horizon is actually growing in area. I'm running out of time, so I won't tell you too much about this, but I'll just mention a couple of things. The first statement that I'll make is the fact that if I look at my perturbed metric, I don't see any sign that the horizon is growing, because in fact the effect is smaller than the order of accuracy that I can achieve in the calculation of the metric. One reason to go to higher order and start calculating these terms over here is that this will finally bring directly in the metric the peel-off of the apparent horizon versus the event horizon. And I think that's going to be very interesting to reveal. But at this order of calculation, the expansion of the null generators of the event horizon is zero. At least to this order of accuracy. Does it mean that I can't do anything? No, because in fact I have access to all the tools that are there to study the structure of an event horizon, and there's a set of equations known as the optical scalar equations. That's essentially a relationship between the Weyl tensor and the shear and the expansion scalar that will tell you in fact how the expansion has to grow in time in this situation. And if you know the expansion of the generators, you know what the area is doing as a function of time. And then if you know what the area is doing as a function of time, well, you can actually relate that through the first law of thermodynamics to what the mass is doing as a function of time. And here's the result of the calculation of the rate of growth of the black hole mass. It's something that's non-zero. The mass grows as a result of time changes in the tidal environment. It's this curly E quantity once again, time differentiated square, with scaling that's coming from the black hole mass. And if you think that this looks a lot like what we'd seen before from the Newtonian situation, well, you're right. This is the formula that we derived before. There's a couple of differences. Here we have m to the sixth. Here we have a to the fifth times a tidal delay, or a viscous delay. So slightly different scalings here with the mass and something that we had here that, well, we don't have in a relativistic situation, or do we? Well, perhaps we do. I mean, if I try to match within numerical factors what I get here to what I get there, I'll say that five of those m's are associated with the radius of my body, which is the Schwarzschild radius, 2m. What's the remaining one? Well, it's this over here. The viscous delay is something that can only depend on the physics of the body itself. It's not something that's set by the scales associated with the tidal environment. And there's only one scale I can associate to a black hole, and that's the mass. So this this tidal delay, or viscous delay, I find up here in disguise, it's one of those six m's that occur over here. So in fact, you can, by analogy, match those results and set a scale for the viscous delay that's at play in the context of the black hole. Of course, there's no viscosity for real here. But having made this match, you can actually compare this formula to the one over there. This is something of order one, and therefore you have an assignment for the effective viscosity of the event horizon. That's not a new idea. I mean, there's been this idea that for all external purposes, the horizon does behave as a stretched membrane to which you can assign electric properties, but also viscous properties. So it's an idea that goes back to the membrane paradigm. In fact, it goes back prior to that to the work of Hartle. But this is something that I think brings out a very interesting analogy between the tidal physics of fluid bodies and the tidal physics of black holes. Well, I think I'm going to cut things off here. Those are a couple of formulae that you would get from the general expression that I wrote before to something involving a more concrete situation in terms of a two-body system. So this would be the slow motion version of what you've seen before. This would be the small hole approximation version, complete with all sorts of relativistic corrections. I won't insist on that. You can note the high power of the orbital velocity so that if you're truly in a slow motion situation, it's not a huge, it's not a huge effect. But if you're working if your small black hole is moving in a rapid orbit around another black hole, well, in fact, you're not limited here by this power. This has become something of order unity, and you're not limited by the small mass ratio. But the claim I would have made if I had more time was that, well, this actually has observational imprints if you were measuring gravitational waves coming from systems like these. So I'll just skip over that, unfortunately, and, just conclude. And, well, the conclusion is just a summary, so I've told you how to describe a tidal environment, both in Newtonian physics and in relativity. I've told you how to construct a perturbed gravitational field, either in Newtonian theory or in relativity, based on the information provided by the tidal environment. In the case of a black hole, you do get a transfer of tidal energy into the black hole, and that translates into an increase of mass or an increase in area of the black hole. That's something that can be called tidal heating in a very legitimate way. Very close and I think very compelling analogy between the physics of black holes and the physics of viscous bodies in Newtonian physics. I didn't have time to tell you that, in fact, there's some measurable effects here, but you can take my word to it. If you're losing a little bit of your gravitational wave energy into black holes, this will impact the energy balance between orbital energy and the other forms of energy, and this is something that does register in the gravitational wave signal. And I didn't talk about rotating black holes, but if you read my papers, you'll see that, well, I do have a bunch of results based on rotating black holes. Here, I don't have the ability to construct the perturb metric of a curved black hole. That's just too difficult. But you can still calculate tidal heating through Tucholsky formalism that is based on curvature, not on metric. So you can still do a lot along those lines. But the results are missing, so I didn't want to describe them. So thank you for your attention, and I apologize for running over time.
So there's an old question, which you alluded to, but you didn't address, having to do with delay versus advance.
Right? Oh, yes.
I mean, you talked about this delay in the Newtonian case. And
right.
You didn't tell us, except through that formula, what the analog is in the relativistic case. And
yes.
In particular, it's often said that there's not a delay, but an advance. But anyway, I mean, that opened up a whole bunch of questions. So can you comment on some of those?
Yeah, so something you would like to do with the perturb metric is to analyze the nature of the tidal bulk from the event horizon and see how it aligns itself with the position of the orbiting body around it. And you would do that in a coordinate system. And given the coordinates, you would either answer that, well, you have alignment or delay or advance. And the answer would depend on the chosen coordinates. So it's a gauge-dependent question. And there doesn't seem to be a gauge-independent handle on that question, at least as far as I know. That's an issue that Hartle faced in the distant past, and there's been some reanalysis of this more recently by a couple of Caltech students. The nice thing about this result is the fact that it bypasses those issues. And this is a gauge-invariant handle on what the net result of the tidal interaction ends up being. And in fact, one of the reasons why I really wanted to analyze the viscous fluid problem is the fact that I know very well that for the viscous problem, unambiguously, we're talking about a tidal delay. viscous delay. And the physics of the viscous delay matches the black hole physics. So that's an argument saying that, well, even though the question doesn't really make much sense, it's a gauge-dependent question, you can certainly believe that it's a delay, not an advance. Because if it were an advance, you would produce the wrong sign here. That's an argument.
You really think it doesn't make sense? Couldn't you, from the bulge, you would have some distortion of the external field, and you could get far enough away that you would be essentially in a flat space, or flat enough, it would sink anyway.
Yeah,
and you could see whether or not this bulge was appearing to, you know, this new source of gravitational field.
Yeah, and one way of formulating this question is to say, you know, from the perimetric, can I extract the quadruple moment term and decide whether it advances or delays with respect to the tidal field? That turns out to be a gauge-dependent question. That's precisely the question that was analyzed by the Catholic students. So everything that you would think should make sense ends up being a gauge-dependent question. And maybe some, you know, maybe you're clever, Raphael, so maybe you can think of the right question that would have a gauge invariant answer to it. And I think that would be great, because I think it's been a really elusive issue, you know, what is the quadruple moment of the distorted black hole? What is the, given the tidal field? And you can, but the state of my knowledge is that the gauge information is contained. The gauge invariant information can be cast in those terms. There are other ways you can present it. But it boils down to that, and it boils down to not knowing what the leading term is in the quadruple moment tensor, but knowing what the correction is, the one that comes from the time dependence of the tidal field. It's really interesting.
Other questions?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.